Good evening, everybody. This evening is going to be devoted to English translations. So just as we had some notes of historical importance in introducing the Aramaic and the Arabic translations of the Bible, I just prepared a few brief introductory remarks about the principal English translations. So in 1530, a scholar named William Tyndale translated the Bible directly from Hebrew into English. And that's the earliest English translation of the Bible. And as you see, it was done directly from the Hebrew. In 1611, not long thereafter, a group of nearly 50 scholars coming from London, Oxford, and Cambridge completed another revised English translation, which bore the name of then King James of England. That translation that was prepared under the influence of Puritanism superseded all of its predecessors and eventually became the authorized version of the Church of England and acknowledged to be one of the greatest literary accomplishments in the English language. Now, anything that's going on in English, in England, at the end of the 16th and early part of the 17th century, got to raise the question, but what about Shakespeare? And indeed, I came across the equivalent of an urban legend. I call it unfounded speculation that Shakespeare actually was a participant in the King James translation. And since we're all accustomed to gematrios, that is to deciding things of import based on the numerical value of letters or frequency and the like, a particularly engaging proof of Shakespeare's participation in the King James translation is said to be found in Psalm 46. The 46th word from the beginning in the King James translation is shake. The 46th word from the end of the King James translation is spear. And arguably, concatenation of 46 and 46 and 46 is arguably because the year 1611, in which the translation appeared, was the 46th year of Shakespeare's life. Therefore, the putting all the 46s together produced Shakespeare in the King James translation, all of which is very nice, save, of course, quite apart from whether the 46th from the beginning and 46th from the end makes any sense whatsoever. We actually don't really know when Shakespeare was born. Therefore, the argument that 1611 was the 46th year of his life is itself specious. In any event, numerous English translations have followed King James, and among 20th century Jewish translations that have influenced contemporary Jewish study of the Bible, and that's why we will focus on them, I've listed half a dozen. The first, now known as the Old Jewish Publication Society translation, that appeared in 1917. The Revised Jewish Publication Society translation, known as the New JPS, that appeared in installments, the Torah first appearing in 1962, and later the Prophets in 78, and eventually the Writings in 84. The Living Torah of Aryeh Kaplan, the Five Books of Moses by Everett Fox, the Stone Edition Tanakh of Art Scroll, and the Five Books of Moses by Robert Alter. The Jewish Publication Society and Art Scroll translations were prepared by committees. The remaining translations, Kaplan, Fox, and Alter, of course, represent their individual efforts. The editorial committee of the the old JPS translation was chaired by Max Margolis, who was the from Dropsy College, and the new Jewish Publication Society committee was chaired by Dr. Harry Orlinsky. And it consisted of Bible scholars H.L. Ginsberg and E.A. Spicer, Rabbis Bamberger representing the Reform Movement, Friedman for the Orthodox, and Grazel, the editor of the Jewish Publication Society. The Committee on Writings, coming out some 20 years later, consisted of professors Moshe Greenberg, Jonas Greenfield, Nachum Sarna, and again, rabbis representing the conservative, reform, and orthodox movements. And this time, Chaim Potok, the noted author, served as the secretary to the committee. For those of you who have a particular interest in this, in 1969, that is some few years after the Torah translation appeared, Dr. Orlinsky edited a volume entitled Notes on the New Translation of the Torah, and it surveyed translations of the Bible in general and those in English in particular. And the balance of the book goes through the Torah chapter by chapter and explains and tries to justify the Jewish Publication Society's decision of how to translate texts that could not be translated literally. Subsequently, the Jewish Publication Society published a series of commentaries on the Torah, incorporating its own translation. Commentaries on Genesis and Exodus were written by Nachum Sarna, Vayikra Leviticus by Baruch Levin, Numbers by Jacob Milgram, and Deuteronomy by Jeff Tige. More recently, JPS has begun to publish an English translation of Mikraot Gedolot, named the Commentator's Bible, edited by Michael Karasik. It has since been completed. The Art Scroll translation was edited by Rabbi Nasson Sherman, the general editor of Art Scroll Publications, and the acknowledgments name Rabbis Avi Gold, Yaakov Blinder, Moshe Rosenblum, Chaim Cohen, Asher Margoliot, and Moshe Shapiro, and anonymous scholars in Israel, who, between you and me, probably are not scholars of the Hebrew University or Bar Ilan persuasion, but probably scholars as an English rendition of Talmidei Chachomim. Aryeh Kaplan was a veritable polymath. He knew sciences, he knew mathematics. His translation incorporates notes that are drawn from rabbinic literature, medieval philology and parshanot, comparative Semitic languages and literatures, and archaeology. We'll see illustrations of all of this evening. Everett Fox, a professor of Judaic and Biblical Studies, patterned his translation after that of Martin Buber and Franz Rosenzweig into German. The most striking characteristic of it is that, like Buber and Rosenzweig, Everett Fox used the same English for the same Hebrew all the time. Okay? Again, consistently replacing Hebrew word forms with the same English translations, and the ingenious representation in English of word plays in Hebrew, alliteration, and even puns that are present in the original Hebrew. Okay, we had occasion previously to talk about the difficulty in translation. One of us is translating metaphors, right? Do you translate the metaphor literally, which could have somebody scratching their head in English, or do you render an equivalent English metaphor, which makes sense, but somehow is lacking the flavor of the original? Robert Alter, a professor of Hebrew language and comparative literature, attempted to render the biblical text in what he himself called a lyrical, lucid English. His commentary, like Everett Fox and like that of Aryeh Kaplan, are annotated translations. That means that wherever they thought that there could be an alternative reading, unlike King James, which had to make a decision and could present only one definitive translation, the annotated translations can cheat, meaning that they can give one in the body of the translation, and then they can have an alternative in the notes on the bottom of the page. There is now yet another English translation. I haven't had the opportunity to study it yet. It's published by Korem. It's called the Magerman edition, and it was started by Jonathan Sachs, and it was completed by a couple of professors at Yeshiva University. As I said, unfortunately, it was completed only within the last year, and I really haven't had the opportunity to consult it yet. So what we're going to do now is we're going to go through a selection of biblical verses drawn almost entirely from the Torah, and we're going to compare a variety of Christian and Jewish English translations of those psukim in order to get to see, as I said, two things. First of all, to see how translators dealt with difficult texts, and to see also whether there's an appreciable difference between the Christian translations on one hand and Jewish translations on the other. And then within the Jewish translations, is there a difference between the JPS translations, the ones that were done by committees, and those translations like Kaplan and Fox and Alter that were done by individuals? So to get us started, here we have a series of psukim towards the end of the book of Bereishit. They tell us about how Joseph, having successfully interpreted Pharaoh's dreams, is freed from prison and elevated to the position of viceroy of Egypt. So in verse 42, it says that Pharaoh removed the ring from his hand and he put it on Joseph's hand, and he dressed Joseph in linen garments, and he placed some sort of golden medallion about Joseph's neck. Then in verse 43, it says that Pharaoh had Joseph driven around in the viceroy's limousine, chariot, obviously. And then the difficult phrase is, Vayikru'u lefanav, and somebody called out before Joseph, Avrech. And Joseph was appointed over the entire land of Egypt, Pharaoh saying to him that only he, Pharaoh, is above Joseph, and everybody else will be subservient to Joseph. So, of course, the question is, what did they call out before Joseph? Now, if you think about it, just last week, we read the Megillah. Now, not surprisingly, the same thing that happened to Joseph happens to Mordechai. Right? That's one of the themes of Megillat Esther. It borrows unapologetically from the story of Joseph. It borrows not only a theme, right? Somebody being elevated to a high position, okay? Not only a theme, it borrows literarily and linguistically. So much so that one can actually say that it is clear that the author or authors of Megillat Esther sat with the story of Joseph, the biblical story of Joseph, in front of them and incorporated as much of it as they could into the story of Mordechai. Now, not surprisingly, Mordechai and Joseph have something else in common. That is, they were related. Now, of course, all Jews are related to each other, but the relationship between Joseph and Mordechai is an even closer relationship, one that the Midrash acknowledges by referring to them as Baneha Shel Rachel. Right? Joseph and Mordechai are two of the most outstanding descendants of the matriarch Rachel. Right? Mordechai, of course, being from the tribe of Binyamin, brother to Yosef. Okay? So just we know that just as Joseph was driven around in the chariot of the viceroy of Egypt, Mordechai was led around by Haman as he sat upon a horse on which the king had sat when he was coronated. So we have a very, very similar situation. But we know that when Haman led Mordechai through the streets of Shushan, he said something, right? There was a proclamation. Proclamation was, Kacha ye'aseh la'ish asher ha'melech chafetz bi'kara, right? Thus shall be done to the man whom the king delighteth to honor. So it seems likely that as Joseph was led through the streets of Heliopolis, wherever the capital of Egypt happened to be in those days, right? That there was also some announcement or proclamation that was made before him. Question, of course, is just what did it consist of? So here we have on the top of the page three English translations, the Venerable King James, a revised version of King James that was done in the 20th century, and something called the New American Standard Bible. Okay. The Venerable King James translates Avrech as, they cried before him, bow the knee. Now, first of all, in context, that makes sense, because if Joseph was the viceroy of Egypt, then of course, just as people bowed down to Pharaoh, people would bow down to Joseph. Okay. How do you get bow the knee from the word avrech? Not hard. The Hebrew word for knee is berech. So if you take avrech as an imperative of the verb to kneel, then avrech means kneel, or literally bend or bow the knee. Okay. Now, of course, just parenthetically, the noun bracha is a derivative of the word berech, meaning knee, arguably because when one was the recipient of a blessing, whether it came from God or whether it came from a mortal king, one would kneel. Okay. The New King James Version, the New American Standard Bible, all keep the King James phrase, bow the knee. And as I said, it's not only linguistically appropriate, but it's suitable for the context. Are we going to find anything else in the, anything different in the Jewish translations? Well, look what we have here. In JPS, they say they cried before him, Abrech. Now, that's just a transliteration of the Hebrew. It's not a translation. And that's not just something that the old Jewish Publication Society kept because in 1917, they were still under the thrall of the King James Bible and they wanted to change it as little as possible. Not at all. Because you see that even the 20th century Jewish Publication Society version kept Avrech. Okay. Why did they do so? You see their note. Okay. Others bow the knee, as though from Hebrew, barach bet resh kaf to kneel, perhaps from an Egyptian word of unknown meaning. So you see, they were torn between the two possibilities. If they knew, if they could determine that it was 100% Hebrew, then they probably would have rendered it as bow the knee. Since, however, they were apprised of the fact that it could be an Egyptian word, then if they had written bow the knee, they wouldn't be faithful to the original. Therefore, what they thought to do was to simply preserve the original in the form of transliteration and let you know by way of a note why they had done so. Now, Kaplan, as I mentioned when I introduced him, drew upon comparative Semitic languages, he drew upon archaeology, and therefore you see that he has a very elaborate note, okay? In fact, how does he interpret the word avrech? He interprets the word avrech as though it were, in fact, the Egyptian equivalent of viceroy, okay? Those going ahead of him announced avrech, the viceroy. And his explanation tells us, first of all, how other translations rendered it. Okay, that's so the Targum, Avrech in Hebrew, since Rach can mean king, and there's a citation from the book of Samuel, okay, therefore the word Av Rach can be interpreted as father of the king, or in the sense that father is a form of elevation, of an archetype, it could mean the ark ruler. Okay. It may also be related to an Akkadian word abaraku, which denotes the chief steward of the royal house. So you can see that he knew what the New Jewish Publication Society knew. He just was more elaborate in his rendition of it. Others, however, he tells us, define Avrech as merciful father, Av. Rach, Rach in the sense of soft, sensitive, merciful. Okay. Still others see it as a command, right? Bow down, that's bow the knee. Okay. We saw that already in King James. It may thus be related to the Egyptian expression aborik. I have no idea how to pronounce it, meaning prostrate yourself, or alternatively, aprek, head bowed. Others see it as related to the Egyptian ibrek, attention, abrek, to the left, right, stand up, etc., etc., etc. So again, we see that this was anticipated by the Jewish Publication Society. However, they chose to be rather succinct in their rendition of it. Aryeh Kaplan, you know, he took advantage of his notations to be more more expansive. Okay. Everett Fox, we see this is how he manages in his translation occasionally to deliver both the flavor of the original without losing the sense in the target language. So they had him mount the chariot of his second in rank, and they called out before him, Avrech, that's just like, right, the old JPS, okay, / attention, which is, of course, what it means in Egyptian, as Aryeh Kaplan elaborated. And he has a note on of his own, Hebrew unclear, some suggest that it is Hebrew for bend the knee, others that it resembles an Assyrian title, so he obviously read both the notes to the New Jewish Publication Society translation and the notes to Aryeh Kaplan. And finally, Robert Alter, the most recent of all of the Jewish English translations, they called out before him Abrech, and his note is, despite the ingenuity of traditional commentators in construing this as a Hebrew word, right, it is evidently Egyptian in consonance with the loan words in the surrounding narrative, and may mean something like make way. Okay. What are the other loan words in the surrounding narrative? The very next verse. The very next verse says that after this Joseph was taken for this, you know, inaugural ride, Pharaoh changed his name to Tzofnat Ta'neach. Now, again, what do you do with that? How do you translate? Do you translate names or do you transliterate names? Okay. Now, if you know, in the English Bible, Abraham is not father of a multitude of nations, even though we're told that that's what his name means. Okay. He's simply Abraham. Okay. Yitzhak is not the one whose birth was met with laughter. Okay. It's simply Isaac. And Yaakov is not the one who holds the heel, right? It's Jacob, okay? So generally, names are not translated. Names are transliterated, okay? So you see that even the New Jewish Publication Society decided to transliterate it, and because they knew clearly that it was Egyptian, okay? And Joseph, Pharaoh gave Joseph the name of Tzafnat Paaneach. Then again, they have a note telling us that the sounds that make up the words Tzofnat Paaneach, meaning in Egyptian, they're not two words. They're a bunch of words, okay? Egyptian for God speaks and he lives. Okay? So if you look at Aryeh Kaplan's notes, okay? Let me highlight it so you can see here. See? Tzafnat is a combination of three Egyptian words. Tza, pa, net. Okay? And pa'aneach is a combination of two Egyptian words. Panach. Right? And taken all together, it means what JPS already acknowledged it to mean. A god, naming the god net, speaks. Right? And Joseph gives life. Well, which is a way of saying that this is a man who communicates with the gods, and therefore the advice that he gave us is going to save us from the famine, and we're all going to live. It all makes sense. But the question is, if these are really an amalgamation of five Egyptian words, how come it appears in the Torah as two words? The answer seems to mean, or likely to be, because the Torah wove the five Egyptian words or sounds into arguably two recognizable Hebrew words. The word sofnat contains the root tzadi pei nun. Right? We're coming up on Pesach, right? Kadesh orchatz, da-da-da-da-da-da, tzafun varech. Tzafun is the afikomen. Why is the afikomen called tzafun? Because we hide it. So embedded in the word sofnat is the notion of something that is hidden. The word lefa'aneach, at least in modern Hebrew, I'm not absolutely sure whether it's rabbinic Hebrew already, means to solve a mystery. It means to clarify something. So mysteries, things that are hidden, are clarified. So in essence, the Hebrew ends up meaning the same thing that the Egyptian meant, which is quite a trick for biblical Hebrew to accomplish, let alone for the English translators. Okay. And again, you can see Everett Fox, just as he did with Avreich, right? He manages to give us both the original by transliterating Tzafnat Pa'aneach, as well as telling us what it means, the God speaks and he lives. The next example. Tries to tackle a curious figure of speech. This verse comes at the end of the long chapter that describes the respective duties and responsibilities in the Mishkan of the different clans of the tribe of Levi. And it ends up with the family, the clan of Kahat. Okay. Who are responsible for carrying the furniture, the furnishings of the Mishkan. That would include the ark, it would include the altar, it would include the shulchan, it would include the menorah. Okay? But the Torah warns them that they only come to transport them after they have already been packed. They weren't transported exposed, right? They were covered. They were enveloped with fabric, and then they were transported. And the Torah says, Lo yavo'u lir'ot kivala et ha-kodesh, that these Levites should not witness the packing of the appurtenances of the Mishkan, because if they were to see that, vametu, it could cost them their lives. Okay. So we understand the sense of it. Okay. The difficulty, of course, is that the word bala in Hebrew means to swallow. So the question is, literally it says, they shall not witness the holy being swallowed up. So, as I said, we know the holy refers to the kelim, the vessels of the Mishkan. And we know that they're being swallowed up means that they were wrapped up, packaged for transport. The only question, as I said, the challenge is, how do you render this in English? So you can see again, King James referred to the holy things and it had them being covered. Okay. However, note that the New American Standard Bible still has them as holy objects, right? The Kodesh. But notice that it understands bala not in the sense of something that is covered up, like if you swallow something, it's no longer visible. But rather it understands the swallowing as not as a physical description of the process, but rather it understands it as a description of the length of the process. How long does it take to swallow something? Only a moment, an instant. Therefore, kivala et hakodesh is rendered as even for a moment. Okay. A look at the English, the Jewish translations, sees again, the old JPS, just like King James, not to see the holy things as they're being covered. The new JPS, little different, not bala in the sense of being covered, but in the sense of dismantling. Now, the Aron was not dismantled before it was transported. The menorah was not dismantled before it was transported. Okay? So the difference, of course, is that they don't translate Kodesh as the holy things. They translate Kodesh as sanctuary. That would be the entire Mishkan. And the entire Mishkan was dismantled before it was transported, because the four walls of the Mishkan were taken apart and they were broken down into the individual panels, right? So by rendering the Kodesh not as the objects in the Mishkan, but as the totality of the Mishkan, they're able to justify translating the Vala et HaKodesh as dismantling. But note that they also add others, that they should not look at the sacred objects even for a moment. So they also understand that kevala could be a figure of speech describing the time rather than the process. Aryeh Kaplan simply has them being packed. Okay, that's a rather generic term, right? Art Scroll has, they shall not come and look as the holy is inserted, lest they die. Now, inserted is certainly technically a more literal translation of swallowing than cover or pack. But I'm not sure what they mean inserted, unless they, of course, mean that they were inserted into their packing. Okay. Everett Fox combines the dismantling and a moment, and he does it by putting one in parentheses. Robert Alter also opts for the moment translation of Kivala, okay, noting that others construe it as dismantling, but that seems a long stretch from the basic meaning of swallow. So he's taking issue with both Everett Fox and the Jewish Publication Society. This is one of my all-time favorite competitions amongst English translations. That's why I call it the Great Face-Off. But of course, it's a double entendre, because the key word in the verse is the word panim. Okay, when Yaakov has returned from his sojourn in the land of Aram, he is about to be reunited with his brother Esav, and since he is leery of how Esav will receive him, because the cause of his going to Aram in the first place was his having stolen Esav's blessing, he sends messengers ahead of him with flocks of sheep as gifts to Esav. And he instructs the messengers as follows, that when they meet Esav, va'amartem, they should deliver the following message. Gam hine avdecha Yaakov acharenu, right? That we're the advance party for your brother Jacob who's following. Ki amar, because Jacob said, achapra fanav b'mincha haholechet lefanai, va'acharechein ere fanav ulai yisa panai. Now, notice that a form of the word panim appears four times in this verse. Okay, Martin Buber coined the word, the term leitwort, which means a leading word, to describe exactly such things as the word panim, a word whose frequency in a limited amount of text is so out of proportion that it's got to be there to lead us in a particular direction. So clearly the word panim here, appearing four times in a single pasuk, and as we will yet see, it appears more than four additional times in the near context of this verse, okay, is clearly a critical word here. So how it gets treated by the translators is very important. So notice, okay, here I dealt only with the Jewish translations, okay? The Jewish Publication Society, the old Jewish Publication Society, as follows. I will appease him with the present that goeth before me. Afterward, I will see his face. Peradventure, he will accept me. Now, without going through all of them, this is an appropriate English translation. L'chaper means to atone. What is atonement? Atonement means that you've done something wrong to somebody and you want him to forgive you. Right? How do you get him to forgive you? You appease him. You apologize to him. You appease him. Therefore, achapra panav is correctly translated as I will appease him. Or in the New Jewish Publication Society version, I propitiate him. Or in Aryeh Kaplan, I will win him over. Or in Art Scroll, I will appease him. Or in Robert Alter, let me placate him. You notice how many different, you know, it's like they say each one sat with a thesaurus, right? In order not to duplicate the same verb, the same word that was used by an earlier translation. So we go from appease to propitiate, to appease, to placate, it's a curious thing, okay? And as I said, it's all legitimate translation of l'chaper panav, other than the fact that it's missing the word panim. Let's move to the next one. Bamincha, with the gift, ha'olechet lefanai, that I sent ahead of me, right? And there we have, goes before me, in advance, sent ahead, precedes me, goes before me. They're all absolutely correct translations of lefanai, save, of course, for the fact that once again, for the second time in this verse, it fails to acknowledge the word panim. The third one, ere panav. Well, that means to look him in the face. There is no other way to say it in English. And that's why that's the only face that's kept by all of the translations. Okay, but then we get to the final one, which is ulai yisa panai. Literally, perhaps he will lift up my face. Now, lifting up a face is a good thing. We know that in English too, because if somebody is upset, they're downcast. And to rectify something that is downcast, you lift it up. Okay. May remember that part of the Birkat Kohanim, part of the priestly blessing, is Yisa Hashem Panav Elecha. Right. So Laseit Panim is a good thing. So what Yaakov is saying is that hopefully, on account of the gifts that I'm sending, Esav, right, when I get to meet Esav and I'm looking at him face to face, Ulai Yisa Panai, he'll be kind to me, right? He will look at me favorably, okay? So as you see, he will accept me. He will show me favor. He will forgive me. He will forgive me. He will show me a kindly face, okay? But once again, here, with the exception of Robert Alter, the third time in the verse that the English translations are eliminating the word panim. Thank goodness for Everett Fox. Here is Everett Fox's rendition of the verse. Now, remember what he said. The challenge is to preserve both the flavor of the original, yet making it intelligible in English. So it's up to you to judge for yourselves whether Edward Fox has done it. For he said to himself, I will wipe the anger from his face with the gift that goes ahead of my face. Afterward, when I see his face, perhaps he will lift up my face. Right? Two ways to look at it. One, as I said, is to say, see, of course it's clumsy English, but I can figure out what it means. And it tells me that the word face appeared four times in the Hebrew original. Whereas any of the other translations may be much more fluent in English, but it doesn't tell me about the prominent position of the word panim in the Hebrew original. Okay. Just out of curiosity, by the way, notice that I highlighted in green the word amar. Okay. And notice that some of the translations take it literally as saying, Jacob said, to whom would he have said it? To the messengers. Okay. Others have it as to say to himself or to reason, right? Which is correct in biblical Hebrew. In biblical Hebrew, we often find the verb amar when it's reflecting not something that was articulated, but something that was only thought. Okay. Now, as I told you, the fourfold appearance of the word panim in this verse is only part of the story. Okay. If we take a look here, beginning here. Okay. Right. Look at the last examples here. Okay. This was verse. We started with an earlier verse in chapter 32. We started with verse 21. The very next verse repeats the word panav, vatavor hamincha al panav. Okay. Then, about 10 verses later, after Yaakov has his nighttime struggle with whomever he struggled, it says that he named the place Peniel. That incorporates the word panim into it. Ki ra'iti Elohim panim el panim vatinatzel nafshi. Because I was able to look an Elohim in the face and live to talk about it. So three more times in one verse, forms of the word panim. And then finally, in the final example here, when Yaakov and Esav are actually reunited, Yaakov says to Esav, "Imna matzati chen be'enecha," right? That if you can look at me favorably, in spite of our past, "V'lakachta minchati miyadi," and you will accept these gifts that I have sent to you, "Ki alkein ra'iti panecha kirot pnei Elohim vatirtzeni." That I recognize your face as the face of an Elohim, and that you have made peace with me, so to speak. So as I said, the word panim appearing four times in the verse with which we began, and an additional six times in the same context, surely meets the criteria of being a leading word. And since we're drawing close to the holiday of Pesach, I brought a couple of examples from the Pesach story. One here from the close of the description of the plague of hail. Okay. We're told, "V'hapishta v'haseora," flax and barley, "nukata," were stricken by the plague of hail, because "haseora aviv," v'hapishta giva'ol. Now, we all know that a nickname for the holiday of Pesach is Chag Ha'aviv. There's a modern Hebrew children's song about Aviv Higia Pesach Ba, And in modern Hebrew, the word aviv means the season of spring. It's not what it means in biblical Hebrew. Not that Pesach isn't in the spring. Okay? But the word aviv, as it appears in this verse, has nothing to do with the seasons of the year. It's clearly a description of the barley plant. And it is an explanation of why the barley plant, like the flax, were destroyed by the hail, whereas in the next verse, the chita, the wheat, and the kusemet, the spelt, lonuku, they were not destroyed by the hail because they were something else. So the question is, what are the physical properties that are shared by the flax and the barley that cause them to be destroyed by the hail? And how does that differ from the characteristic of the wheat and the spelt that spared them from the hail? Once again, we have to see, how did the translators struggle with this? So first of all, I just brought you the definition, dictionary definition of the word afelot. You may recognize the Hebrew word afela means darkness. So does it mean that wheat is dark? It's not dark in the sense of describing its color. But if dark also by extension means to be concealed, right? Then if a crop is concealed, it means that it hasn't sprouted yet. So basically, if we start there and work backwards, we can understand. Wheat, right, ripens, matures later in the year than barley. You all know that. You may not know it as a principle of farming or agriculture or agronomy, but you know it from the association with holidays. On the second night of the holiday of Pesach, we start counting the Omer. The Omer was a sheaf of barley. So Pesach has to match barley. Okay. What do we celebrate on Shavuot? On Shavuot, the Shtei HaLechem, the loaves of wheat bread that were brought into the Mishkan weekly. So that gives us an indication that barley ripens 7 weeks earlier than wheat. Barley, Pesach, is situated at the time of the barley harvest, and Shavuot is situated later at the time of the wheat harvest. So since the plague of hail was even earlier than Pesach, right? The stalks of wheat were immature, okay? And because they were immature, when they were struck by the hailstones, they didn't snap, they didn't break, they just simply flopped over. And therefore, they subsequently were able to straighten up again. Whereas, by implication, the flax and the barley were already ripe, and therefore when they were struck by the hailstones, they snapped. Okay. How do you get that out of the text? Here we see the translations. Okay. Barley and flax was smitten, for the barley was in the ear, and the flax was in the boll, like a boll weevil, right? That part of the plant. Okay. The wheat and the rye, they translated as rye rather than as spelt, were not smitten because they weren't grown up. Doesn't say because they were immature, because they were concealed, they weren't grown up, but it amounts to the same thing, okay? That's why in the New King James Version, they just simply substituted they are late crops, which is a descriptive term, right? Correct, and a descriptive term, but not really a translation of the Hebrew, okay? Just to save some time, looking at some of the Jewish translations, okay? Ripen late, late in sprouting, ripen late, late ripening, and finally, Robert Alter, right? Unripen. Pretty much all the same, Okay. And finally, when Moses gives his instructions to the people on how to celebrate the very first ever Pesach, he not only gives them instructions about what animal to take and what to do with its blood and how to roast it and everything, but he says, V'chacha tochelu oto. Right? He's giving instructions on how it should be eaten. Motnechem chagurim. Right? Your loins girded, meaning your belts should be fastened. Okay. Why? Hold on. Na'alechem baraglechem. Your shoes should already be on your feet. Makelchem biedchem. And your walking sticks in your hands. Now, do people ordinarily sit down to a meal with their walking sticks in their hands? No. Do people customarily sit down to a meal with their shoes on? Yes, in our society, yes. But in a society in which people generally went barefoot, unless they were actually undertaking a journey, I assume that an ordinary meal was taken barefoot. So that also is extraordinary. And you only buckled your belt when you were preparing to do some physical activity and you didn't want the folds of your garment to get in your way. So each one of these three things is clearly something that was an exception to the way in which people customarily sat down to eat. Why were they told to do these unaccustomed things? V'achaltem oto, because the Pesach should be eaten b'chipazon. Okay? Pesach hu l'Hashem. Two things with this verse. One, of course, is what is the word chipazon? It's clearly, as I said, the explanation for these three unaccustomed activities. Okay? The secondary problem is, what we've been talking about for the whole chapter, is all about the Korban Pesach. So you have to remind me again that it's a Pesach for God? Hold on. Let's take the word chipazon first. Everybody assumes that chipazon means haste. Haste, 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 haste. Everybody's got haste. Okay? Except New JPS has hurriedly instead of haste. They sat there with their Roger's thesaurus and decided to substitute hurriedly for haste. Otherwise, everybody seems to have haste. Okay? Haste, haste, haste. Okay, except for Everett Fox again. So, makes sense, right? Meaning, if you don't know when you're going to be leaving Egypt, and you might have to leave in the middle of your meal, you don't want to have to pause at that moment and then first buckle your belt, put on your shoes, and take your walking stick. Okay? Therefore, arguably, since they could be called upon to leave Egypt at any moment, right? They clearly had to be prepared to leave at any moment, and therefore they sat down to their meal dressed for the journey. Problem is that we know that the Korban Pesach was brought ba'erev. It was brought at the beginning of the night of the 15th day of Nisan. Whereas they didn't leave Egypt until after the plague of the firstborn, which only started at midnight. Therefore, the idea that they sat down to their seder, so to speak, dressed in order to be able to leave at a moment's notice, even though they had plenty of time to know when they were going to leave, right? Their meal was not going to be interrupted. You know, it doesn't make sense. Therefore, take a look at Everett Fox, who, with good reason, came up with an alternative for chipazon. he decided that the instructions to eat the Korban Pesach were to eat the Korban Pesach in trepidation. Meaning, they should be anxious while they were eating the meal, right? Anxious, lest they be called upon to leave, but not necessarily eat it in haste. Because if haste were part of the description of their, part of their instructions, then it would mean that they had to sit down with their belts buckled, their shoes on, with their walking sticks handy, but it would also be instruction that they had to eat quickly. And that just doesn't seem to be a reasonable instruction. So he notes that others say in haste, but he tells us that the element of fear is also contained in the verb chet pei zayin. If we were to spend the time and look at some of the medieval commentaries on this, and some of the modern commentaries as well, we'd see that there is an interpretation that says, yes, there was chipazon, there was haste involved in the Exodus from Egypt. But the haste wasn't on the part of the Israelites. The haste was on the part of the Egyptians. Once the Egyptians saw the plague spreading, they are the ones who hastened the Israelites to leave, as the Torah has them saying, lest we all perish. So I hope what I've been able to do successfully is to share with you some, as I said, just some of my favorite examples of how English translations develop over the course of time, and how they struggle with such questions as how do you treat metaphors, how do you treat figures of speech, and certainly how do you treat unusual linguistic forms or expressions. Let me have a look at the chat. I don't know offhand what Saadia did with Avreich. Chipazon, meaning trepidation during the Seder, reminds me of, I'm not going to ask why. That's it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Please God, we'll see you next week. And tomorrow, Shuli Mishkin concludes her series on archaeology with the topic of Shivat Zion, the return to Zion. So that's tomorrow at 12 noon. Tomorrow evening at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, Rabbi Eitan Aviner, who was in charge of the Israel program at Rabbi at Yeshiva at the B'nai Kiva schools here in Toronto, will be giving the Parshat HaShavuot here. He spoke many weeks ago, you may remember. He's on Shlichut, actually. He lives in Israel. He's on his fourth year of Shlichut here in America, a graduate of Rabbi Riskin's program, I think, and then of Kolol Eretz Chemda. Rabbi Carmel, and then Friday morning 9 a.m. of course my shiur on the Siddur. That all are welcome to all our shiurim, and please invite a friend. Menachem Liptek Sunday morning, beginning his series, a two-part series really on Tehillim as understanding of Sefer Magid, of Magid of the Haggadah. So, anyways, we look forward to learning with you and your friends. Everybody, be well. Laila tov, and thank you very much. Okay, bye bye. Yes, Dr. Sokolo, that is correct. I noticed that too. Somebody's pointing out that your handout didn't have the opening part where you went through all the translations. So I don't know.
I'll tell you what. I'll send you the revised part, and you can just switch them.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay. Okay. Laila tov, everybody.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom. Oh my gosh, it's only Wednesday. Okay. But
Rabbi Sokolov will not.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, everybody else, we'll see you hopefully before then. But
Hashem tomorrow.
Yeah, okay. Shabbat shalom, Dr. Sokolov. Yes, yes, yes. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Good night, good night.